At its peak, the British Empire controlled a quarter of Earth's land and population, the largest empire in human history. Yet this staggering achievement began not with grand strategy, but with pirates robbing Spanish treasure ships. While Spain discovered American silver mines, England found none. So the English simply stole Spanish gold on the high seas, with privateers like Henry Morgan becoming folk heroes. This wasn't empire building, it was organized crime that happened to pay extremely well. What transformed piracy into commerce was an addiction, England's insatiable craving for caffeine and sugar. Between 1746 and 1750, tea imports tripled. Tobacco, initially condemned by royalty, became ubiquitous. These stimulants, glucose, caffeine, nicotine, didn't just change trade patterns, they rewired English society itself. The consumer revolution extended to fashion, with Indian textiles replacing traditional English wool across all social classes. Empire emerged not from military ambition, but from the mundane human desire for a good cup of tea and fashionable clothing. England's breakthrough came through an unlikely corporate merger. After losing commercial wars to the Dutch, despite military victories, England coveted their superior financial system. The solution? The 1688 Glorious Revolution, essentially a hostile takeover where Dutch Prince William of Orange became England's king and Dutch businessmen became major shareholders in the East India Company. This merger imported crucial innovations: the Bank of England, a national debt system, and a stock exchange. Suddenly, England could borrow cheaply to fund wars and expansion. The company established three fortified trading posts that became major cities: Madras, Bombay, and Calcutta. After military victories at Plassey and Buxar, it secured something extraordinary: the right to tax over 20 million Indians. The British had transformed from pirates to traders to tax collectors ruling a subcontinent. The primary purpose remained profit extraction. The drain of capital totaled around 18 million, often transferred as diamonds, returning nabobs built stately homes and bought parliamentary seats. One Indian observer noted bitterly, "The English have a custom of coming for years, then going away, scraping together as much money as they can and carrying it in immense sums to England." Between the 1600s and 1950s, over 20 million people left the British Isles, the largest exodus in human history. This mass migration turned whole continents white, but the settlement model was first tested in Ireland, where James I confiscated rebel lands and gave them to colonies of civil people of England and Scotland. American colonization proved brutally difficult. Only 38 of Jamestown's original 100-plus settlers survived the first year. The breakthrough came with tobacco cultivation in 1612, which rapidly exhausted soil and encouraged westward expansion. Tobacco plantations demanded massive labor, leading to the transatlantic slave trade. Ship Captain John Newton's journal reveals this dehumanizing commerce, referring to enslaved people as "it" and recording deaths by number. In plantation colonies, whites were often outnumbered 10 to 1, necessitating brutal force. The sugar industry treated both cane and humans as raw materials, with mortality so high that planters replaced 8 to 10% of their slaves annually. Yet resistance was constant. Jamaica experienced 28 rebellions between British acquisition and abolition. For African Americans and Native Americans, American independence was actually a setback, as Britain moved toward abolishing slavery, while revolutionary leaders like Jefferson maintained their slaves despite declaring all men are created equal. By the Victorian era, the empire shifted from exploitation to moral redemption. Britain sought to improve the world through Christianity, industry, and ending barbaric customs. The abolition movement united religious groups, ending the slave trade in 1807 and slavery throughout British territory by 1833. Britain then deployed naval squadrons to pressure other nations to follow. David Livingstone's missionary work exposed the gap between propaganda and reality. Despite years of preaching, Africans remained indifferent to Christianity, valuing him mainly for medical skills. His sole convert, Chief Sechele, quickly returned to polygamy. Livingston abandoned missionary work in 1848 to become an explorer, envisioning the Zambezi River as God's highway into Africa. In India, cultural imperialism intensified when Governor General William Bentinck banned sati, widow burning, in 1829, ignoring warnings that interfering with religious customs might provoke rebellion. The feared rebellion erupted in 1857 when rumors spread that rifle cartridges were greased with cow and pig fat, defiling Hindu and Muslim soldiers alike. The Indian Mutiny was fundamentally a war in the cause of religion, a direct consequence of the missionary impulse gone catastrophically wrong. Three technologies built Victorian Empire's infrastructure: telegraph cables, steamships, and railways. India saw over 24,000 miles of track laid within 50 years, what contemporaries called the annihilation of distance. By 1881, the Indian Army numbered nearly 70,000 British troops and 125,000 native soldiers, over 60% of all British imperial garrisons. Lord Salisbury called India an English barrack in the Oriental Seas, from which we may draw any number of troops without paying for them. After the 1857 mutiny, British rule transformed. Cities like Lucknow were redesigned, expelling residents, demolishing two-fifths of the old town, converting the principal mosque into barracks, and creating broad boulevards for military movement. Railway stations became fortresses. The British escaped summer heat by retreating to hill stations like Simla. At 7,000 feet, it offered a highland-like refuge with Gothic churches and cool mountain air. Kipling appreciated its champagne air while questioning rulers spending half the year cut off from those they governed. The technology-enabling empire also enabled escape from its realities. The Indian civil service relied on native bureaucrats. Without them, British control would have collapsed, given the British never exceeded 0.05% of India's population. Following Thomas Macaulay's vision to create a class of persons, Indian in blood and color, but English in taste, in opinions, in morals, and in intellect, thousands of Indians pursued Anglophone education. This created a fatal contradiction. London needed native elites as collaborators, while British residents demanded their subordination. By the 1860s, the White Mutiny erupted when Anglo-Indians mobilized against the Ilbert Bill, which would allow Indian magistrates to try Europeans. The campaign revealed profound sexual anxieties, with letters obsessing over English women facing half-clad natives in court. Viceroy Ripon's compromise, allowing white defendants juries with at least half European members, exposed Anglo-Indian contempt while catalyzing Indian nationalism. The empire had created its own destroyer, an educated, English-speaking elite who recognized the hypocrisy of being deemed equal in theory but inferior in practice. You cannot teach people about liberty and justice, then deny them those very things, and expect them to remain grateful subjects. Singapore's fall in February 1942 marked the empire's greatest humiliation. 130,000 imperial troops surrendering to a Japanese force half their size. The Japanese deliberately humiliated white prisoners to destroy Western prestige, and it worked. Britain needed American support to win World War II, but this came at a cost. The 1956 Suez Crisis exposed Britain's new weakness. When Egypt's Nasser nationalized the Suez Canal, Prime Minister Eden struck back despite American warnings. The invasion triggered a run on the pound. Only after Eden agreed to unconditional withdrawal, Eisenhower arranged a rescue package. This humiliation accelerated imperial dissolution. The British aimed to catch the first boat home, regardless of consequences. In India, Mountbatten's hasty departure contributed to communal violence, killing hundreds of thousands. The empire that took three centuries to build was dismantled in just three decades. Britain discovered what all empires eventually learn. The moment you stop believing in your right to rule, you've already lost. Today, scattered remnants remain of what once covered a quarter of the world's land surface. Yet the empire's legacy has shaped the modern world profoundly. The English language, spoken by roughly 1 in 7 people, stands as perhaps the most important export. British legal systems proved particularly beneficial, with common law countries having stronger protections for investors. Colonial institutions often enhanced economic prospects by securing property rights, enforcing contracts, and maintaining stable government. Between the 1840s and 1930s, the empire facilitated unprecedented free trade and labor mobility, driving global income convergence. Yet America, the empire that inherited Britain's mantle, is an empire in denial. It possesses larger economy, population, and arsenal than Victorian Britain, but lacks the drive to export capital, people, and culture to regions needing them most. Following September 11th, Tony Blair advocated reordering this world around us, rhetoric bearing striking resemblance to Victorian imperialism. The question isn't whether empire exists today, it does. The question is whether we'll acknowledge it honestly and learn from history's lessons. The British Empire built the modern world through exploitation and institution building, greed and genuine belief in improvement. We cannot understand today's interconnected world, its trade networks, legal systems, language, and power structures without confronting the empire that created them,